Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
You can tell I've been doing it.
Here's John Williams.
Thinking some big thoughts, to be honest with you. This is John. We're in the Skyline Studio, downtown Chicago. I'm more intrigued by Jordan Bernfield's story about a kid using a fake ID. Oh, to be so young that you need a fake ID in your back pocket. On the one! Just one observation about that, Jordan. So the kid had the McLovin ID in the back pocket, the same way McLovin did in Superbad. But my understanding is that schools and bars and places are a lot tougher about fake IDs than they used to be. When you were young, when you were 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, did you have a fake ID? And, you know, was it pretty easy to fix or get somebody to make one for you? I know I had friends and their kids went to Indiana and places like that. And I think if you went into a bar in Bloomington, Indiana, and your ID was fake, they did more than just take the ID. I think they called the cops or the school or something like that.
When I was at Purdue, you would not only have to use your ID, but a second form. So like a credit card or something. You always had to have two just to get into a bar.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you're a lot younger than I am, so you're a little closer to what I'm talking about here. It just seemed to me like once upon a time, and this used to be the time when cops, if you had open liquor in the car, would say, pour it out and drive home, kids. Come on, that's enough of this. That's enough of this shenanigans. And now, of course, it's much, much different. When you tell your kids, hey, you cannot drink and drive, and then your kids say, well, what did you do? You can always say, oh, we drank and we drove.
Yeah, but
it was a different world back then.
Well, it's a different world for the kids, too, because I think that they really don't at all like we used to.
You don't even think they're tempted like we were?
Not all of them, obviously, but I think it's a much different mentality now.
I do, too. Well, I don't know where that came from. I don't know that it's because they're afraid of the consequences, or I don't know what it is. You know, I had a son that was in extracurricular activities, and I said, you know, as much as you like to play sports, you won't get to play sports if you're caught drinking and driving. When I put it this way, Steve, when you were in high school, did any of the kids ever act as a designated driver?
What?
That concept had not been invented in 1980. That just wasn't out there.
And can I tell you, that literally happened to me. And a cop pulled us over and took the bottle and just dumped it on the street.
You know, I say that never happened to me. Literally, the cop let you get away with that?
Yeah. I hope mom's not listening.
Yeah, well, you know, you survived it. And I there's no excusing it now, but I'm sorry, it was just a different world back then. And so you would, like, just scratch off your ID and change the birth date, or you'd get somebody who looked like you, sort of, and you'd make a duplicate of theirs. I mean, it was a whole thing. And then change some of the information. You wouldn't put McLovin on there, but you'd get a fake ID and you'd kind of get away with it. And if you didn't, it was no big deal. But I think now, would you get arrested, Lauren, at Purdue, or would they kick you out of school? What would the consequences be? Do you recall if you were caught using a fake ID at a bar?
I think it kind of depended on the bouncer, but they were definitely more severe. I've heard stories of the cops being called, but I've also heard just stories of them saying, get out of here.
Yeah, right. This is why a lot of university presidents, and I mean, I've talked about this before. Again, when my son was in college, I was more attuned to this because for part of his college years, he wasn't 21, of course. And his university president at the time was one of 100-plus university presidents who signed an open letter saying that kids should be able to drink under the age of 21 on campus. If you are a college student on their campus, they did not want to police alcohol. That makes sense in a way, doesn't it?
Well, because they're likely doing it anyways.
They're going to be doing it anyways. And some of them are athletes and some of them are the star, the player, whatever it is. And all you do is chase kids all around campus all the time. You know, what's the point of that?
As long as they're not driving or hurting anybody.
And I also think it sort of encourages the sort of, you know, reckless behavior that we engaged in when you say, okay, it's 21. Well, you're 20 and you're at the University of Illinois, for crying out loud.
I mean,
can't drink?
19 and 20 years is just fraught. It's just not, it should be fixed in some way.
We talked about the milestones that you see your kids go through and how you feel about them. When your kid gets to 21, oh, You don't have to worry about that anymore. I mean, they could still drive drunk, but maybe they'll be less likely to be in any of those situations because now they can drink responsibly, legally. Barb wanted to say something. You're on WGN. Hi, Barb.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, my fake ID said I was 21, born, I don't know the year, but I lived in Hollywood, California. And all my, you know, itinerary that's green eyes, blonde hair. I got in all the bars when I was 18, 19, 20.
Were you blonde-haired and green-eyed at the time?
Oh, yes.
So you had the statistic, the information right. You weren't from Hollywood, California, though, were you?
No, I was from Dalton, Illinois.
But if you had to, if you're going to make a fake ID, Hollywood, what the hey, that's more interesting. Yeah. Do you have kids?
I do, and they're all grown. My daughter lives in England.
Yeah. It's just funny because when you watch your kids go through that, you hope they don't do some of the same stupid things we did, right?
Yeah, they're over 21, so and then, it's a relief.
I'm telling you, I know how you feel. Barb, thanks for the call. Marianne, you're on WGN. What did you want to say, Marianne? Hi.
Hi. Well, we used to get together as a group on Friday nights or Thursday nights, and we would meticulously sit down with our IDs, and we would use a white crayon. And I was born in 68, so we would crayon out the 8, and then we would take a straight pin, and we'd scrape away the white crayon to make it look like a 3. And we never once had anybody question us at any bar.
Did it look convincing?
Oh, yeah. You could not tell the difference.
Wow. You couldn't do that now. The IDs are made differently.
Exactly.
And you know why? Because of you, Marianne. It's your fault.
I suppose my friends and I will take ownership of that.
Yeah, well, and society is better for it. That's funny. Thanks for the call, Marianne.
All right, thanks.
Have a good day. Hey, Bob, you're on the air. You're on WGN. Bob, what's up?
My experience is not with drinking, but I was in a bar underage, and I played in the band. So this is in Cleveland, Ohio, and you could be 18 at that time to get in bars. They sold 3.2% beer. And so I was only 17, and I played in the bar, in the band, rather, and I'm on stage, and a cop comes up to me and says, and I looked really young. I probably looked like I was 15, you know. And a cop says, how old are you? And I said, 17. And he stood there and he stared at me for a minute. And then he said, well, at least you're not hanging out on the street. And he just walked away and let me be.
You kind of wondered why he bothered to ask if you said I'm underage.
Yeah, but I thought, oh well, here goes the band, here goes my play, and I'm out of here. And he just let me be. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I bet you these days that story ends differently. Not tragically, but just my guess is the cops aren't as forgiving now. It's been a long time since I've been carded. Bob, thanks for the call. I'm going to Bernie next.
Wait, is that true? It's been a long time since you've been carded?
Yeah. The only time I get carded now are the places that have to card everybody.
They don't have to card everybody.
Oh, they do.
They don't.
Why are you upset about that?
Because I don't want to show my driver's license every time I go to Walgreens.
Makes it so much easier for the person at Walgreens.
I'm 56 years old.
Yeah, what if you were 30
okay,
and
then card for people who look like they're 48.
And now you've made it a judgment call for the register person.
It's a ridiculous waste of my time.
I got carded at the Deadpool movie.
Well, you should.
That's
you
18 look like, you years could, old.
Is that why
I was 24.
You go to the grocery store, they ask for your ID.
I'm always ID'd.
And they don't always ask for it at every store, John. I'm sorry, I'm derailing you, but...
No, that's okay. It's all part of the conversation. I think if this is a hassle for me, how much of a hassle is it for that person selling beer at Wrigley Field? They don't want to card everybody. They card everybody. They got a sign that says, we card everybody.
In one of my weaker moments, I have several of them, I was at a grocery store and buying a couple bottles of wine with all my groceries, and they asked for my ID. And I said, forget it. I don't want the wine. I wouldn't do it.
Oh, really? I want the wine.
It bothers me that much that, I mean, I'm
It bothers me, but boy, I sure want that wine.
I've got gray hair. I shouldn't have to show you my ID.
Steve, I was behind a guy in line at a Benny's, and he, or someplace like that. He was buying liquor. He did not have his ID. I'm going to put him at 70. He was in his 60s to low 70s. They didn't serve him.
That's ridiculous.
The sign says, we card everybody.
Here's what I've seen before at the store. I have seen the customer berate the clerk for carding them. Yeah, and it just makes you feel bad for the clerk, because what if it's someone who's also under 21 who, I guess, are they allowed to card? Yeah, who's younger and maybe a little more innocent, and they're just trying to do their job correctly.
That's
not
right.
Get
they got
fired.
A boss. This is just their job.
Yeah, I know someone that got a ticket, a huge ticket for not carding somebody because they were caught by an undercover person.
See? Yeah, but if you're not carding someone who's underage, that's different from carding someone who's 70.
Steve, that 70-year-old guy could have been a plant. He could have been a plant by the cops to make sure the clerk...
There's no law that says you have to card everybody.
There isn't?
No!
Okay, there's a law that says that you can't serve to somebody under 21, though.
Right, and so then if you don't card them and you sell, then you've broken the law.
And
but
this 70-year-old guy probably isn't 20 years
old. He's probably not, and in my defense, when I did refuse to buy the wine, I instantly felt terrible, and I had to stand there for five more minutes as the checkout continued, and I'm trying to make happy small talk because I know I was kind of a jerk. But
well, wait a minute. So you take this stand, and then you stuck around to try and patch it up?
I was buying groceries, and the bottles of wine were part of my groceries.
So you still got to watch the stuff go through.
Exactly.
Did you have your ID with you?
Yes.
Wait a minute. It was you. It was from the distance between your butt and that person's eyeballs, all of this goes away?
Yes.
Holy cow.
Because I've been to that same store where they don't card me, and I don't know, maybe I was just in a mood. But
you were in a mood, fella.
It was bothering me.
Promise me you were in a mood.
Yeah.
Suddenly I feel differently about your wife.
I don't know how where to go with that.
I mean, I just think she's got her work cut out for her.
We all know that's so true.
I didn't know you were that, what's the word, temperamental?
Petulant?
Yeah. Pick your word. There's a lot of them. It's 121. My number's 312-981-7200. Jordan Bernfield in the 1 o'clock news did a story about a kid who got his ID confiscated. It said McLovin on there, et cetera, et cetera. Ha, ha, ha. But I was wondering about the difference between your ID experience and what it's like today. And all of our phone lines are busy. I didn't even get to my wisdom about the weather. Lots of texts, lots of calls about the consequences of underage drinking and driving and using a fake ID. Steve, you like this. 630 texted in and said, John, I'm 68 now, but when I was 31, I had a fake ID saying I was 21.
Nice.
That's good. Well, you know, if you start early and just every ID get it renewed 10 years younger, if you get that rolling at 31, it's easier to pull off when you're 41, 51, 61. So there you are, 68, and your ID says you're 58. You've been doing it since you were 31 with an ID that said you were 21. A lot of people, when they're 20, get an ID that says they're 30. Why not roll it back the other way? Hey, Steve Bertrand, I went to Marquette when I was 18. I went to Marquette when the drinking age was 18. Remember the block parties?
Oh, my God.
When Marquette University gave us free beer?
They would do it twice a year. And I was there for the centennial of the school, so the 1981 block party, where they shut down, like, Wisconsin Avenue. But it would be there would be hundreds of kegs of beer free. In fact, we threw a party in our parking lot, like 2 years, one of the block parties, and had a beer truck in our parking lot.
That seems to be irresponsible on the school's part.
Well, it's a beer town, and it was paid for by and large by like Miller and Pabst and those guys. Those breweries used to have local school representatives, and they would be in charge of, I'm not kidding you, they'd be in charge of handing out the t-shirts and the caps and to the new students who came in.
How tough is that account? If you work for a brewery and your account is Marquette University or the University of Illinois, I would imagine you, that's a pretty easy sell. You ought to be able to sell some beer there.
Yeah, well, they competed against each other. But,
well, there's that.
But then they got rid of the block party, I think, when I was still there, so early 80s.
Hey, Larry, you're on WGN.
You and Steve better not go to the Elk Grove Jewel because they card everybody. And if the checkout person is under the age of 21,
they have to send over a manager or someone else.
21, please. And then they wait, and then they walk over, and then they look at you, and then they beep, scan the beer.
And I understand that. I mean, I'm not, I think I'm pretty reasonable here, but I think
you're reasonable at all.
I think it's reasonable to card everybody.
Yeah, I do, Steve. But Larry, I'm on your side. I'm on the Jewel side on this one, buddy.
He didn't say he was on
your
side.
You have to be nowadays.
Yeah, thank you for the call. Yeah, pardon me, Larry, I cut you short there. What did you want to say, Larry?
You have to be careful nowadays.
Yeah. No arguing that. Bernie wanted to say something on line four. Hey, Bernie, you're on the air.
Yeah, hey, thank you. Listen, back in 1966, I found a guy's driver's license. That was in Illinois, and that was before they put pictures on it. And it was some height and weight and everything. And I used his to get in all the bars. I was like 16 years old.
Yeah.
You know, turning 17. Got in all the bars and all that. I said, wow, it was fun. But here was the thing. I'm a black guy. I have gray eyes. But the driver's license showed it brown eyes. They missed it.
Well, did they have that license you found as Caucasian?
No.
Because that would have been a real...
No, they didn't have that.
You know, it's funny. I don't ever remember that. But, yeah, you got to put at least a picture on there. I mean, come on. Let's get with it.
That's great. Back in the days, back in those days, because I had a driver's license. It had all I had was your date of birth, height, weight, and color of hair and eyes. That was all there was.
Bernie, that must have felt like a winning lottery ticket. It's like, woohoo, I can drink now.
Right, exactly. You know that.
Thanks for the call. And you said two real quick, Aleph, and then we got to take a break, right? That's line two, and that's Glenn. Hey, Glenn, you're on the air.
Hey, John, this is going out to Steve. They send a 70-year-old person here, like, you know, it might be a trick or something. It's because it may not be the state law that they have to check your ID, but it could be the company policy. And if that cashier fails to do it for you and that other 70-year-old person, they get fired. So it's just a company policy, may not be a state regulation or anything like that, but that cashier is, you know, protecting their job.
No, I get that. I'm not against the cashier. I'm not against the cashier. I'm against the policy.
I appreciate the call. Thanks for joining us. It's 129 on WGN. My thought about the weather was that October is the last good month we have. November's iffy, and then it's going to get really bad for 4 months. I had more to say about that, but this has been more fun than what I had to say about the weather. It's 1:30. After the news. What are we doing after 1:30, Aleph? I want to turn the page and make sure I've got it. Oh, yeah, Phil Vitale's going to join us, restaurant critic for the Tribune. In the 2 o'clock hour, we'll visit with Aaron Del Mar. Aaron Del Mar is going to join us in the 2 o'clock hour. He's the Palatine Township Republican Party chairman. He's the guy that's in charge of selling the lunch with the president tickets. I find this fascinating.
Well, I wish I had better news. I think we still have a lot of areas that we need to settle on.
Dennis Jackson was on our show yesterday, and yeah, no kidding. Still hoping to hear from the CTU. I would prefer they negotiate these things on my show, you know. It would be good for the WGN Radio. It's 1:40. The end of the day, of course, we all just hope that they get that thing done, but it's not looking so good, is it? Phil Vitale's the restaurant critic for the Chicago Tribune. He joins us frequently on Wednesdays about this time. Phil, thanks for coming into the studio. How are you?
I'm good. Enjoying being back here after a week and a half down in Orlando to see my mom, my sister, my brother, and Mickey Mouse, not in that order.
How was the weather in Orlando?
The first day we arrived, it was teeming rain. The second day, we walked around one of the theme parks with umbrellas just in case. It only drizzled on us a couple of times. And then it was clear sailing for the next 6 days.
So my theory about the weather is that November is not the worst month. Like, you know, we're just now coming to grips with the fact that summer is over.
Phil, do
not have any more 80-degree days.
He's been threatening to give us his theory of the weather for the whole show. So
I see.
Apparently you're the winner.
It's a 4-2.
Here we go. Hands on buzzers.
It's a 4-2-5-1 equation. 4-2-5-1. So you have four lousy months. December, January, February, March. Those are the lousy months. That's like, oh, why do we live here? Mm-hmm. But there's only four. So October's been pretty nice. We've had a nice summer by and large. And then November could go either way.
Right.
But I'm not putting November in the good or the bad bank. That's the iffy one.
Right.
So you get that one. Then you get the four lousy, December, January, February, March. And you tell yourself December at least is fun. That's a fun month.
Right.
A lot going on there.
Right.
So really, you just need to survive January, February, or March.
Yes, right.
April and May can break your heart.
Yes.
April and May, you don't know. Those are two more iffy months.
Right. Those are the ones you resent.
You really do. The average high temperature in Chicago, April 1st, what do you guess? What is the average high temperature April 1st in Chicago?
45.
51.
Whoa.
Maybe a little warmer than you thought.
Mm-hmm.
And on May 31st, all right, here we are on the eve of June now. May 31st, the average high temperature.
60.
Is 68.
Wow.
Yeah, it might surprise you. The last day of May this year, it was 82. So
these months aren't as bad as we remember them.
Right. But this year, it was really, by and large, April, May, June were just awful. Up until July 4th.
Somebody stole spring.
No kidding. So those are the two more iffy months, are April and May, and then you've got June, July, August, September, and October, five good months in a row, the big five that we live for here in Chicago, and we're still in the midst of that. So enjoy it now, then November, and then just buckle down.
Yep.
December, January, February, we'll get through this thing.
At least on November 1st, all the candy's on sale.
You would say that.
Silver lining, right? You just look for the silver lining.
Do you mind if I just take one call?
Not at all.
We're talking just before you walked in, Phil Vitale, restaurant critic, Chicago Tribune, about people using fake IDs, what it's been like over the years for all of us. Jim, you're on WGN. What did you want to say? Hi. Hold on, Jim.
You talking to Jim?
Yeah, I am. You're on the air, bud.
Hey, it's a fellow dog lover.
Hey!
When I came back from down there, I went to work for a bar in the northwest suburbs that had about four locations, owned by one of the ex-Bear quarterbacks. And while bartending, unknown to me, I served one of the people on the other side of the bar that worked as a server, and she served the drink to an underage person. I got arrested and went to Niles Cook County Jail for about 4 hours waiting for that ex-quarterback to come and bail me out.
So let me see if I got this right. You give the drink to the waitress, and then she finishes the deal with a customer who's an underage plant, and you go to jail?
Yep, I poured the alcohol.
I know. Wow.
That sounds like a sting.
Didn't happen in Carbondale. I remember walking down the street with 2 six-packs of Old Style on my belt.
I know. In Carbondale, they didn't care.
Everything happens differently in college towns. There are bars that let people in that are underage, but they have to wear an ID that says don't serve them liquor.
Yeah, but I think an under 20-year-old person, I think if you're 20 years old, you should be allowed to sell alcohol, right?
Mm-hmm.
You should be allowed to sell alcohol.
Well, but then you're putting that 20-year-old under pressure to sell to her friends or his friends.
Okay, maybe. Because, if you're in line at the Jewel,
mm-hmm,
and they call out 21, why are they calling out 21?
Because the cashier is under 21.
Yeah, not because they doubt your age, but because that's a young person. So then Marge comes over, and she just, beep, looks at you.
Scans the two bottles.
I'm like, really? Did that accomplish that much right there?
I might be mistaken, but I'm pretty confident that at Whole Foods, even it goes beyond just being 21. You have to be, there are certain people there who are trained to sell alcohol.
Yeah.
So you could be over 21 and not be able to do it.
Wow.
I think that's happened to me.
My personal opinion is that if you're allowed to enter into a binding contract or be drafted into the Army at age 18, you should be allowed to have a beer.
I disagree with that. I always have.
Quite a few people do.
I've never understood that equation. I mean, I understand that we're asking you to do a lot if you, well, nobody gets drafted, but if you volunteer.
Anymore.
Say it again?
Anymore.
Yeah, right. But I mean, if you are willing to serve our country, I really appreciate that. But I'm not sure that the reward should be alcohol. I mean, why not give them, I don't know, a raise or better health care?
Oh, sure. I don't see it as a benefit. I just see it as defining adulthood.
Huh. Fair enough.
And then the rental car companies don't want anything to do with you until you're 25.
Yeah, which is really weird.
Mm-hmm.
I've run into that with my kids before. I said, rent a car. I can't. You recently reviewed an Indian restaurant, is that right?
Yes, last week. Rue. R-O-O-H. And the chef, Sujan Sukar, has restaurants in New York and San Francisco, very well regarded, and several places in Great Britain and India. And he came here earlier this year and opened up what you'd call a rather contemporary take on Indian cuisine. For instance, he has a dish that's actually made, it's kind of like an Indian tuna tartare. You know, that's a fish you're not going to find in India, but he just kind of combined the two, that ingredient with a traditional Indian preparation and came up with a pretty good dish.
Hmm. Roux. So is it not traditional Indian food then?
All the preparations and the spices, the flavors they use, they're all from tradition. Keeping in mind that India is a huge country and traditions can vary quite a bit within those parameters. But then he'll use ingredients that you would not, say, find on a traditional Indian restaurant, or you wouldn't find in India. You may not find tuna being held with very much.
What did you give it?
I give him 3 stars.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Kind of pricey? Indian restaurants usually aren't.
Right. On the grand scale of Indian restaurants, when so many of them are the really inexpensive buffets, this is really pricey. But you're paying for quality ingredients and to order preparation, and it's a legitimate restaurant. It's not food sitting out on a steam table somewhere waiting for you. And then there's a place for that economically, but I tend to prefer the pricier ones.
It's funny, though. Chinese restaurants are that way. A lot of Asian-based restaurants are that way. So the food will be delicious, and sometimes they'll have a little table in the area where you're waiting for your takeout.
Mm-hmm.
And even if they've expanded it to have a dining room, it never sort of reaches the level of comfort that Western American restaurants have, you know, an American steakhouse,
right,
or something like that. And I don't know where the disconnect is.
I think it's a slow process. You'd have to go back about 50 years and realize that formal Italian restaurants were practically unheard of. It were all little mom and pops, and they had this. You go to, you have places, you even have a pasta buffet on sometimes at lunch just to get people in. Ultimately, the customers decide what kind of restaurant you're going to be. And if your client base of the kind just want an $8.95 buffet, well, you just cinch your belt and say, okay, we'll do an $8.95 buffet.
Well, I'll tell you what, though, for $8.95, you could probably get $18.95 if you served some decent cocktails and spruced up the joint a little, mm-hmm, bit. I mean, that's what we do here in America.
Right. It takes time. It takes time for the public to decide, yes, this is worth paying a premium price for. Arun Sampathavivat opened up Arun's more than 20 years ago. It was a hit. It was upscale Thai. And since then, it has been followed by approximately zero upscale Thai restaurants. Nobody else has been able to clear that bar.
Yeah.
A couple tried, didn't last very long.
Yeah.
It's quite perplexing.
That must be the challenge for restaurateurs, is to know the marketplace, right? So mm-hmm, John Williams just came up with a really good idea. Guess what? He didn't. He didn't come up with a really good, mm-hmm, idea. That's not going to fly. That's not going to go. They have to know that. They're putting their money and their careers, their food on the line. If they guess wrong, they're in trouble.
Right. And tastes change and they ebb and flow. Right now, Korean is a much easier sell as a cuisine. People are, oh, Korean, yeah, let's go to Korean. Well, I'm sorry, it was Thai. Oh.
That was last week.
Yeah. Hmm. Let me check
this.
My schedule.
It's 150 on WGN. My number's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. The sometimes popular Phil's Flash Fry segment is next. This is where you just call in and give us an area, a restaurant, a food that you like or you have a question about. You can brag about a place or you can ask about a place. Phil will do his best to take on all comers. Where would you like to know? What would you like to eat? Where do you want to go? 312-981-7200, WGN. Folks still recollecting their getting carded experiences. 312, I was elected president of my fraternity while at Marquette University in 1984. The next day after the election, I got a call from the Miller rep wanting to know how many kegs we needed.
There you go.
It was a different time.
There was an intense competition between those breweries, too. It sounds weird, but it really was. There weren't microbreweries, you know. If you spent up, you were getting a Heineken or a St. Pauli girl.
But it would still seem to me like the universities themselves as institutions would look askance at that. Not sure if askance is a word, but you know what I mean.
Well, it's a beer. It's a, you know, it's changed, but it's a real beer culture there. What made Milwaukee famous?
I have a joke, and the punchline is the beer that made Melfamy walk us. Do you want to hear it sometime?
After you're done with the weather.
John, in 1984, I was sentenced to 20 hours of community service at the Peoria Public Library for giving a police officer a fake ID. And then somebody sent in their fake ID that they still carry with them. It says, John, I use this when I get carded, maybe at the Jewel, but it's a picture. It's Frank Sinatra's driver's license.
Oh.
It's Frank Sinatra's signature, photograph, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Just handed Frank Sinatra, Beverly Hills, California, gray hair, blue eyes, 170 pounds, 5'11".
To this day, nobody messes with Frank.
I know. What are you going to do, card Frank? No, you're not.
No, you're not.
The news, or Phil's Flash Fry in 60 seconds. Speaking of good food, my producer on Saturdays, Griffin, is about to, he's about a month now into Seattle Sutton's Healthy Eating Plan. Lou Manfredini does it. Steve Cochran here does it. They love the food. They love the fact that they're eating smart and losing weight. Griff likes the convenience. He loves the fact that now he doesn't have to make out a grocery list or shop or cook or plan or even clean pots and pans. The meals are delicious and delivered to his doorstep. And there's a lot of variety, too. You never with Seattle Sutton get the same meal twice over a five-week span. You and I can't say that. There are no gimmicks, no diet fads. This is the food you should be eating forever. They've served 90 million meals. And there are 20-plus Chicagoland distributors where you can easily pick up the food or have them deliver it right to you. How about that? Here's the number to call, 1-800-442-DIET, 1-800-442-DIET. Visit SeattleSutton.com. I'm gonna be right. All right, we got 2 minutes, Phil. Phil's Flash Fry for two whole minutes. This is where you call in. I love you most of all, my favorite. All right, Paul, you're on WGN with Phil for the Phil Flash Fry.
Okay, here we go, Phil. So, the thin crust pizza, like Vito and Nick's in the south side of 84th and Pulaski is where I like to go.
Good place. I like that place.
Yeah, great place, great pizza, authentic, you know, homemade pizza by pizza making generations. Where else would you recommend that I go? And there are others that I have in mind, but I'd like to hear your opinion.
Thin crust pizza we're talking
about. Yeah, we're talking about thin crust almost the tavern style. They don't cut it into squares at Vito Nick's, but
where's the
they
place
do have
Vito
really
Nick's?
Thin. Vito Nick's down on Pulaski and 94th. Is that 80, too far?
Yeah, 84th and Pulaski. 84th. They cut it into squares. They use fennel seed in their sausage.
Wow, okay, hold on. So give us another one. What else
that's
do you
a
like?
Legit. This is like the party pizza, so I don't get into that very often. So my thin crusts are more like Peace Pizza up on North Avenue. And as you know, I'm a big fan of Robert's Pizza here right in North Pier, the old North Pier, now River East Arts Center, excuse me.
By the Winters Jazz Club.
Yes, right next door.
Yeah.
You get your pizza and your jazz. How do you beat that?
Yeah, no kidding. Winters Jazz downtown. And the name of that place is?
Robert's. Pizza and Dough Company.
Phil, where can I get good German food?
Milwaukee.
Berlin.
The German scene has really been, you know, they've just been shrinking back. People, they retire. Nobody's there to take over. There's still the Berghoff. We still have the Berghoff.
That is true. That is true. All right, I'm out of time. I got a list of questions for you from texts and calls.
Oh, give me some homework.
We're only going to do this segment next week. Next segment, I'll give you the homework. All we're doing is Phil's Flash Fry next week. Only Phil's Flash Fry next week.
Right.
Stay well, Phil.
Okay.
Phil Patel, restaurant critic, Chicago Tribune.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
It's 11.
Here's John Williams.
This is John. We're here at now 2:07 till 3. Rokan, Anna DeVlantis and company after 3 o'clock. Remember, Saturdays, 10 to noon. I will be in the studio this Saturday from 10 to noon. Haven't been there in a while. Last Saturday, we were in Elgin at the lovely Elgin Community College and their beautifully redone Blizzard Theater for our Teddy Roosevelt show, which was so good. By the way, if you didn't see that, and 500-plus of you did, there was a couple of empty seats, but most of you, of course, didn't. We're going to post it as a podcast. I'm just kind of editing out the beginning and end and cleaning it up so it'll be as easy for you to hear if you want to listen to the whole show, and I think you'll enjoy it if you do. So we'll put that up soon enough, and we'll keep you posted on future shows that we might do with Teddy Roosevelt or Thomas Jefferson. I will play a little of that probably on the Saturday show. That's this Saturday from 10 to noon here on WGN Radio. The Northwestern football game this weekend, I think, is on Friday. I think it's Friday night. So, did you see that little story in the paper here? Van Dyke formally resigns from CPD. I'm reading from the Chicago Sun Crimes. Jason Van Dyke, who was convicted last year of murdering Laquan McDonald in an on-duty shooting, has resigned from the Chicago Police Department. He's serving a nearly seven-year prison sentence for second-degree murder. Formally resigned last week, according to a spokesperson. Comes just under 5 years from the date he fired 16 shots at the 17-year-old McDonald. Do we all remember that story? Do you realize that was now 5 years ago? Van Dyke, who was on the force for 18 years, will not collect a pension. His attorney's on a phone line. I got a couple questions for Dan Herbert. Hi, Dan. This is John Williams. Thanks for joining us on WGN. How are you?
Good, John. How are you?
Good. All of that's correct, as I just read it out of the paper, was it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Andy Grimm's reporting in the Sun-Times today. So was that ever in question or in doubt? Would he get a pension or not? How does that work?
No, it's per the statute, if a police officer is convicted of a felony in relation to his or her duties, then they do not receive a pension. This, obviously, he was convicted of a felony, and a little argument could be made that it was part of his duties.
I suppose most people would say, well, gee, in this case, that's just, but that's too bad for his wife and kids then, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's something that, you know, we literally talked about even before the indictment came down. It, you know, they're hurting financially. There's no question about that. But it's not a blow to them in any way, shape, or form, because it was something that, you know, we knew.
They knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, even if we got a not guilty. I mean, it was, they were going to fire him. I mean, that would have changed the pension situation, but you know, he didn't have so much time on that it would have been really impactful.
Oh, I see. So it's not like he was sitting on, how long was he on the force, did it say?
I think he was, God, I've gotten away from the case. I think it was 13, 14 years. So
yeah.
He would have collected an annuity, which, you know, would have been probably $600 a month.
Is his wife working then?
She is, yeah.
So that's how, I don't know if she was working before, but she's the breadwinner for the family now, right?
She is the sole breadwinner.
Yeah, right. And then if it says, I don't know why that was a story, Van Dyke formally resigned. So even as he's been sitting incarceration in prison, he was a Chicago police officer last week?
I guess it depends on your characterization. I mean, he was, the day he was indicted, he was put into a no-pay status. So so essentially, you know, he is, I guess, technically, he would be required to follow the rules and regulations of the police department while in a no-pay status. But other than that, there's really no difference between his position now and then.
Yeah. What is the family like? What is he like? How, now that the sort of dust is settled on all of this, what would you say about them?
They're very strong, and they don't have that defeatist attitude. You know, it's, I've never once heard, you know, woe was me, or it's, they understand the gravity of the situation, and they are doing everything they can to make the best out of what they hope will be a decent rest of their lives and their kids' lives.
Yeah, if it's a seven-year sentence, he gets out in 6 years? Do you know offhand?
No, he could be out quite a bit sooner than that. You know, it's at 50% time, and he could be out as early as 2022.
So they must feel, as a family, pretty fortunate about that, right?
Yeah, I said after the sentence, is, you know, as hard as it was, you know, they, when they were looking at a death sentence, they were, you know, so happy just to know that they're going to have a chance to get their family back together. So, yeah, it's hard, but, you know, they're looking forward to the future, and they're really actually pretty positive people.
I wonder, you know, I think a lot of people listening to this, I'm just asking you questions about the situation. I'm not taking a side. In fact, I think that he's fortunate to get a sentence that is as easy as that is for him and his family. And I'm still pretty upset with how the Chicago Police Department handled this case overall. I don't know if he or you have anything to say about that, but I think what bothers us is not just the mistake that he made that day, but the cover-up that the police department was involved in.
Yeah, I would say to the cover-up, you know, that the focus and the main thrust of the cover-up was that the detectives did a cover-up, and I think that's really been proven as a false narrative. If there was a cover-up here, it was done by the politicians to keep this tape from coming out. But the detectives, I know it makes for a good story, but the reality is they would not try and cover this thing up because they knew that this tape was existed. I mean, they did what they normally do, and they, you know, accentuate the positives and downplay the negatives, but it wasn't in any way to cover anything up because they don't have control about the release of the videotape. So these lowly detectives, and I don't mean that derogatory, but, you know, they assume that it's going to get out, you know, in short time. But it was the supervisors and the politicians who did everything in their powers to keep this tape from coming out. But
that's not the way I remember it, Dan. I mean, they didn't see, they did not know that the tape would be released, but for a year. And
well, the detectives had no, they have no control over that. I mean, you know, that's way, way above their pay grade. They have nothing, they inventory it, and once it gets inventoried, it's out of their hands.
Well, I think the general consensus, this isn't why I called, but we're just having a conversation here. I think the consensus in Chicago is that police officers wrote reports that weren't entirely accurate to better help your client.
Yeah, I would agree that that is definitely a consensus, and I would agree that there was some things put in the report that absolutely should not have been put in reports. But I don't think it was in an effort, I'm not going to say I don't think, I know this situation pretty well, and I know some of the people involved, and they were not trying to cover anything up as much as they were trying to, you know, make it a good shooting. And, you know, I guess if people want to characterize that as a cover up, so be it. But I just, you know, there's nothing to cover up here because the whole thing was caught on videotape. So their intentions, I don't believe, were cover up. It was simply to make the shooting as good as they possibly can, which unfortunately was the policy and practice during that time.
Have things changed?
I think everything has changed as a result of this case. I know, you know, I had already talked to detectives prior to this and said, you know, my humble opinion is, you know, forget about this. It's just accentuating the positives. Just report the facts. You know, they were trying to almost be too good at their jobs and to and to thwart, like, civil suits and defenses. And, you know, that's not their role.
Dan, you sound like you're still working for them. I mean, it seems to me like they never thought that that video was going to go public, and we never would have seen it but for one enterprising reporter who said, something doesn't smell right here, let's see if we can find the video. And over a year later, it was released. The police officers wrote reports that were just not accurate, and there was never going to be any video to prove otherwise. Your client is a free man, but for the release of that video, because the reports would not have put him in jail.
Yeah, I agree with the latter point, but, you know, and I understand there's been so much written that it's impossible for a lot of people to think otherwise, that it's a cover-up. But, you know, this videotape, it would have been released at the very least to the Independent Police Review Agency, and that would have been a part. It was released to the state's attorneys, to the federal government, to the Independent Police Review Agency. So, you know, policemen have no idea what's going to happen with the video once it's in everyone else. Once they inventory it, they know it's going to these various entities. So, you know, I don't think it's, I really don't think it's true to say that they thought, you know, this thing would have been buried until after all these civil suits and criminal cases took place.
I think this should happen going forward. Maybe you do agree with me on this, that the police should have to write those reports without consulting with each other right away. They shouldn't get 24 hours. They shouldn't be able to sort of put their heads together and say, okay. I mean, I can see the value in that, but I think that's been abused. I think they need to tell their version of the events so that if we get conflicting versions, then we'll know something's afoot. But if they all get together and write the same report, well, then to me, that's an opportunity for some sort of fraudulent reporting.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you on that. The only thing I would take issue with is the giving them time to write the reports. With respect to the shooting officers, you know, it's science. It's well documented and it's been scientifically accepted that the effects on the body after somebody was involved in that traumatic situation make it 100% impossible for them to give an accurate statement until they get two full cycles of sleep. And the police, Chicago police, get I believe it's 24 hours before a shooter makes a statement. You know, the federal government, who is extremely progressive, as we all know, they give their agents 72 hours. So if the goal here is to get an accurate statement, then I think that that they should give the time because it's been proven you will not get an accurate statement.
Dan Herbert's on the line, Jason Van Dyke's attorney. We just noticed the story, maybe you did too, that Van Dyke, quote-unquote, formally has resigned from the CPD. He has not been getting paid, and he will not get his pension. Folks are asking questions like what happens to the money that he paid into the pension for the last 18 years. Do you know that one, Dan? What happens to all of that?
Yeah, that money is his, and he will get that. But that is it, and I think they give him a real small interest percentage on that.
Somebody else wanted to know, well, I'll just let him ask a question here real quick, and then we'll wrap this up. And that's Ralph on line one. Hey, Ralph, you're on WGN. What's up, Ralph?
Hey, guys, thanks for taking my call. I just want to know if there's somewhere where I could send in a donation to help out the Van Dyke family. Regardless of whether if it was right or wrong, the guy needs help. And, Dan, my question for you is, as a third-generation policeman, why didn't you have a defense of mental illness? Because those of us who have been police officers know how stressful the job is, and sometimes you do the wrong thing because you're under such pressure and stress. I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for the phone call.
Yeah, thanks, Ralph. As far as donations, I don't know. There was a GoFundMe page. I don't know if that's active, but you could send it anything to my office, and I will make sure that I get it to the family and 206 South Jefferson. With respect to your last question, we did essentially present not necessarily a mental defect that would render him not guilty of having the mental state, but it was a diminished capacity, and that was based upon all the physiological aspects that were going on with his body during this incident, but there was not evidence to support a legally insane defense.
Yeah. I think Chicagoans are going to talk about this case for a long time to come. Dan Herbert was Jason Van Dyke's attorney. I appreciate your time today. It's just kind of a lingering question when you saw that story. You know what I mean, Dan? You say, wait a minute, he just now resigned. He's been in jail. But this clears up some of that for us. So technically, he's no longer on the force. He had not been getting paid. He will not get a pension, correct?
Correct.
I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us today.
All right, John. Take care.
Yep, Dan Herbert. Here's another story that's in the news. You saw the president is coming to town, right? Is that our next guest on the line? Aaron Del Mar, the Palatine Township Republican committeeman, is on the phone line. So I don't know that I'm going to go to this thing. Maybe you are. I was kind of curious how this even works. Hey, Aaron, this is John. You're on WGN Radio. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. So tell me about yourself. Palatine Township Republican Committeeman, is that what you are?
That's correct. I'm also the deputy chairman of the Cook County Republican Party and a former two-term chairman of the Cook County Republican Party.
Do you have a connection with the Trump campaign per se?
Yes, I'm going to be a delegate to the RNC convention on the Trump-Pence ticket coming up next year in Charlotte. Really excited about that.
So he is going to be in town speaking to a police convention, right?
Yeah, he'll be down for the convention. He'll be speaking to them. And then afterwards, we're going to be having a fundraiser on October 28th in downtown Chicago, where people are going to have an opportunity to meet with the president, potentially be at his roundtable, have a photo opportunity, and enjoy a great luncheon.
So 1028, it's the police chiefs that are in town, right?
Yes, sir.
And so I've kind of wondered about how that works, too. I presume that the police chiefs want the president to speak to them, right? And is that a sort of, maybe you don't know the answer to this, but an endorsement by the police chiefs of America of Trump or his campaign or his policies, do you know?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that that's probably coming around the corner. He's done a great job for supporting not only our troops, but supporting our local heroes and police and firemen here at home. And we're real excited about getting that endorsement.
He hasn't been through Chicago very often, has he?
No, not really. Chicago, as you know, Illinois is a pretty blue state. Not a whole lot of votes to be picked up during a general election. He was here a couple times during the primary, spoke at the City of Chicago luncheon, did a couple fundraisers, obviously visited Trump Tower. But I expect to see him a lot, hear a lot more because, you know, Chicago is a great fundraising town. This event that we're going to be putting together on October 28th, we expect to probably raise a couple $1 million here locally. So that's really going to give a big boost to the nationwide campaign.
Ricketts is his, national treasurer for his campaign?
Yeah, Todd Ricketts is the national finance chairman. He's also the co-owner of the Chicago Cubs, as we all know.
Is the event going to be held at Wrigley Field?
I'm not allowed to disclose where the event is going to be at this time due to the request of the Secret Service, but all those that are a ticket-holding person will be getting the full information, be vetted through Secret Service, and it's going to be a pretty intimate event. The last one was awesome. So we're expecting a great turnout, a great fundraise, and a great night.
Is there ivy at the location? Can you tell us that?
I know, I was just going to say, we're going to get it out of you, Aaron.
Well, the last fundraiser they did last year was at Mr. Ricketts' home. It was a sellout crowd. You know, he lives in a pretty nice place, as you can imagine. So we're expecting to have a similar type atmosphere and ambiance at this event.
Not the ivy we were thinking of, though. I bet you could tell us places it's not going to be. Do you know that it's not going to be at Wrigley Field?
You know, I really can't disclose where it's going to be or where it could be at. I mean, I know they've done a lot of beautiful refurbishment to the field and added a new hotel. So I do encourage a lot of people to go out and support the Cubs and Todd Ricketts and the whole family over there. But it should be pretty exciting for those that make it out to this event. I think it's a one-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be up close and personal with the president.
So I saw $35,000 for lunch and a photograph. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a $35,000 per couple. That's either a give or a raise. So if you are able to, crowdfund $35,000 or more, you and one of your closest friends or spouse could get a picture with the president and, you know, get a good handshake in there. So you don't actually have to pay the full $35,000. You can make that as a fundraising goal. And if you raise that amount, you know, get the same opportunity.
Yeah. Do you have anything a little less than the $35,000 area?
We sure do. The $35,000 is a pretty high watermark for a lot of people, me included. To get into the luncheon, it's a $2,800 per person lunch ticket. And again, it's going to be very intimate. It's not going to be one of the large rallies that you see. I can't promise you that it's not going to be at Allstate Arena. It's not going to be something that large, a big rally. This is going to be a more private, intimate opportunity to talk to me with the president.
Will the First Lady be with him?
You know, we don't have confirmation on that. I know they do try to travel together, so there could be a surprise guest with the First Lady. But I would be willing to venture. There's going to be a lot of familiar faces, a lot of prominent Chicagoans there. So it's going to be a great room, a great opportunity to network as well.
It's interesting because when they had a rally or an event like this that was scheduled in California, was it San Francisco or Hollywood? It was some place that, you know, the president doesn't have real deep roots. It was a blue area. And then there was an effort to find out who the people were that bought tickets to this to sort of out them. And the argument went, hey, if you're going to write a check to the president, if you're going to stand up for him and help him, then you ought to be able to put your name on the dotted line, so to speak. And there was pros and cons and an argument about that. Has there been any conversation about that? Will we know who the people in Chicago are who go to this event?
Yeah, I mean, federal election law requires that there's full transparency and disclosure with any kind of donation to the campaign. And this one is what we call a direct donation. So this is not like the dark money you hear about that's going to other corporations where this is hidden. This one will be released on his fundraising goals and everything online. So you'll be able to get an idea of who attended this event.
Yeah. Any idea? What's your goal? How many people do you think will attend?
You know, we're not really looking at people per se. You know, our goal for this raise is going to be between $3 million and $5 million, which I totally think is within a reasonable opportunity with the amount of people and the amount of, you know, supporters that they have in here. I mean, Chicago and Illinois, as we talked about earlier, it's just totally a blue state. However, there are some great Republicans that are here, and as soon as you step foot out of the city limits, Illinois, for its most part, is pretty red. You got a little bit of Democrats down south, close to that St. Louis area, and obviously in Chicago. But for the rest of it, it's predominantly Republican. Hence, you know, we had Bruce Rauner as our previous governor.
Yeah. Well, the people are blue, but the geography is red. There's no doubt about that. One last thing, then, if people want tickets, how do they get them to this?
Yeah, they can reach out to me. You can email me at aaron@palatinerepublicans.org. Again, that's aaron@palatinerepublicans.org, and I'll get you over the private invite, and then you can send your information back to me, put you through the vetting of the Secret Service, and we'll get you in the room.
Aaron, good luck to you. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
I appreciate you guys. Have a great one.
Yeah, you have a good one, too. Aaron Del Mar, Palatine Township Republican Committeeman. I know why you're playing this. Thank you, Steve Bertrand. It's 2:39 on WGN. This is John Williams. After the 2:30 news, we asked producer Ella to play us a song and tell us why.
Madonna begins her 7-night run at the Chicago Theater tonight, but she seems to have stirred the pot with a late start time of 10:30 each night. It's been reported that a lot of fans prefer not to be out until 1 a.m. on a work night.
You know, you're getting older when your rock and roll show starts at 5:30, and that's upsetting to people. It's rock and roll. It's Madonna, for crying out loud. If you can't go to the show at 10:30, you shouldn't go to the show.
Are they using the theater for other things?
Maybe they couldn't get a nice room until 10:30.
No, it's her whole tour is starting at 10:30 at night.
That's how she rolls, man.
And it says in the story, quote, Madonna will come out when she's ready.
Yeah, well, that's...
She's trying to force relevance down our throats.
Right.
She's always been a diva. This is the deal. If you really want to see Madonna, and you may, I think you'll stay up till 10:30. Maybe you'll take a nap around 4:30, go to Old Country Buffet, and then go out.
I've gotten up twice by 10:30.
I'm usually up at 10:30, but it's the second time, yeah. All right, thank you for that. Good luck to Madonna. Ella, see if you can get Madonna to come on the show. She'll be getting up about now, so maybe she can come by sometime this week. In our studio is Robin Staines. She's the president of something called Advance Illinois. Robin, welcome to the studio. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
We share this building. We're neighbors, aren't we?
We are. Good building.
I bumped into some of your colleagues in the elevator, and they said, you know, someday we should talk on your radio show, John, and I believe today's that day. What is Advance Illinois?
So Advance Illinois is a bipartisan nonprofit organization that works on policy and advocacy to improve schools and education in the state.
Are you publicly financed? What are you guys?
We're privately, philanthropically supported.
You're like a think tank?
Well, yes and no. I mean, we certainly think, and we certainly pay attention to the research, and we do things like produce this report we're going to discuss, but we also do grassroots work and then get actively engaged in rolling up our sleeves and affecting policy.
The idea is to make education better, more effective in the state of Illinois?
To make it more effective, to make it more equitable, and we've had some progress, but we've also got some challenges.
Do you promote policies then? Are you a Republican or a Democrat or a big spend or a no spend? What are you?
So we're bipartisan, very deliberately. Our founding co-chairs were Governor Jim Edgar and Bill Daley. So we're statewide. We've got Republicans, Democrats, teachers, principals.
These reports come out every 3 years?
Every other year, typically. We skipped 1 year, but every other year we sort of pull together all the data to take a look from early childhood to higher ed. How are we doing?
This is sort of like our educational census, if you will.
It is.
And what do we know?
So we know a lot. It's hard to condense us into one sentence. I think the safest thing to say is there's some good news, some signs of progress. And then there's a lot of bad news as well.
Give me the best news. So what did this report say? Hey, good job, Illinois.
So the best news, I think, for the state is that we are growing our children better than the nation between the grades of third grade and eighth grade. And we're in the top 10 nationally in terms of how much progress our kids are making. In those 5 years, they're making more than 5 years of progress. And even better, we're seeing particularly strong gains, best-in-class gains, from our Latinx students, which is a big deal.
What does Latinx mean?
Our Latino students.
And third through eighth grade,
right,
they're getting even more than 5 years of growth.
Exactly.
And by that you mean test scores, standardized achievement
exactly.
test scores? So they're testing better than they would even if they only progressed a year each year and better than the rest of the nation.
Exactly.
Hooray for us.
Yes. Now, here's a bit of bad news to go along with that, unfortunately. A couple things. One, while overall we are doing well, 4 out of 10 districts in the state are exceeding the national average. That means 6 out of 10 districts in the state are not. And the other thing is, and it's quite important, is that even though students are making better than the 5 years of gain, doing better than their national peers, and we're 6th in the country in math growth between 3rd and 8th grade, our proficiency in math is actually 30th in the nation. And that's because despite those faster paced gains, kids are coming into the kindergarten system well below what they should be. And the gaps between students across race and across income are already pretty profound.
Is it understood that there's a range at which education is most important for the overall academic health of a person?
I mean, you know, people always want to sift and sort. And the truth is, and you know this from raising your own kids, it all matters. I will say that the fact that even our better than national average gains in 3rd through 8th grade aren't good enough to get kids to proficiency reminds us that if you don't really invest in those first 5 years, if you don't get kids off to a strong start as early as kindergarten, they're going to pay a price for that throughout their process.
That's what I thought you were going to say, that if you had to pick a spot, you wouldn't want to discount anything, but if they're off to a bad start, it follows them for the rest of their lives.
It does, but I would all get the other end of the spectrum as well, which is if you look at our post-secondary system, we are not doing a terrible job. We have more kids who are enrolling, more kids are completing, and every group is better educated today than it was 10 years ago and 15 years ago. All of that is fabulous news, but we're 42nd in the nation in terms of equity, meaning that the way we're doing that job is leaving too many kids behind. And so if you do everything right birth to five, and you do everything right when you graduate kids from high school, and you send them into a post-secondary system, which increasingly you need to get a living wage job, and those institutions are not equipped to really help all students complete, we still haven't done our job. We're still letting those kids down. So, yes, those first 5 years are absolutely bedrock essential. But, boy, oh, boy, we can't let up at any point, and that includes post-secondary.
So kids graduate from high school, and they really can't get through college. They don't have the academic skills.
Well, they are getting through, though there's but you're seeing real disparities in how well they're getting through. Though it is interesting and it's worth saying that at every step, what you see is that about a third, our school system is working well for about a third of our students. About a third are at grade level in 4th grade, about a third are at grade level in 8th grade, and about a third, about 38%, are graduating high school with the skills they need. 85% are graduating, but if you look at the percent that are graduating with the skills they need, it comes down closer to a third, and about a third are completing post-secondary. Eerily consistent.
A lot of information there. I'm encouraged to hear 85% are graduating high school. I didn't think it was that high.
It is, and we do pretty well. We're ahead of the national average on that, and what's particularly nice about that is that we're closing gaps. So not only have we hit the 85%, though that's still 15% of kids we need to work on. But the gaps across income and across race are narrowing there, which is nice.
Narrowing. So I presume Latinos and African-American students aren't doing as well as white students. I saw one of your graphs that indicated as much, right?
Yes.
But you said that a third, when they graduate from high school, even though 85% are graduating, only a third really have the skills to go on to college?
Yeah, so we have an 85% graduation rate. 38% of students are demonstrating college-ready skills. If you multiply those numbers, which is statistically messy but not off track, you get about 32-33% of our ninth graders complete where they want to be. Well, what it means is that we have to do the upstream work earlier in the process, that we need to make sure that more than just a third of kids are reading a grade level in third grade. And before that, we now have kindergarten readiness data. The last time we issued this report, we didn't know how our kids were doing as they entered kindergarten. The first time we had a snapshot was third grade. That's late. We now know that kids are entering. 26% of kindergartners are coming in ready to go across developmental domains, academically, socially, and emotionally. 26%.
So 74% are not.
No.
What do we do about that? How do we fix that?
Well, I think there's a number of things we need to do. And again, the data in the report lay out a couple of things. First of all, we've worked really hard as a state to get kids into pre-K, three-year-olds and four-year-olds. And we do pretty well. About 85% of our 3 and 4 year olds have access to, particularly from low income families, have access to state supported pre-kindergarten. The problem is twofold. One, many of those pre-K experiences are half day, not full day, when what you really want, if you really want a strong start, they need the full day. And the second is, because of the way we do our funding, some places get all the funding they need and other places get nothing. And so we have deserts. We have places in the state that between the ages of birth to five, not just pre-K, but also the earlier intervention services, you've got communities with very, very little.
Is that the Chicago area or is that downstate?
No, Chicago tends to do better, actually, than some of the other areas. And one of the things that actually you can do in our report is you can take a regional look and you can look and see how your area does on some of these metrics.
In our studio is Robin Staines, president of Advance Illinois. It's a Chicago-based organization that looks at these sorts of academic metrics and then issues a report. It's not a Republican or Democrat or conservative or liberal organization. As you can tell, they're just all about these numbers. And you don't give prescriptions per se, do you?
Not in this report. This, for us, we do have many policy positions and things we want to happen. But we want this report to be not a policy document. We want it to just get information out for so that everybody is making informed
decisions. But then, so then if I was at a round table that was going to be set up and everybody had a copy of this, one of the things that I think should happen, I mean, I'm really worried about those kids that are five and under, but how is it that that's not the parent's responsibility? If we looked at that and said, gee, there's a failing here by the state, it's a failing by the parents, isn't it?
Well, that's actually, I don't think, the way we would look at it. I mean, you know, those birth to 5 years, I think, first of all, even if you didn't care about responsibility, we all need to get it right, because if kids are not coming in, there's a price not only they're going to pay, but we're going to pay as an economy and as a state.
Yeah.
But the truth is, we all need help, and it depends on how much parents are working. If you've got a single working parent or if you've got a double working family, you want to make sure that kids are getting, have a good, enriching place to go. Also, even kids before 3 and 4, you've got kids who have needs that have developed, medical needs, developmental needs, and we've got services, but we haven't made those equally available around the state. So we could get in front of some of these problems, and those are bigger than what a parent can handle at home.
Would you say this is an example of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer? That is, I wonder if some of these gains that you were talking about are really being driven by some of the suburban schools with resources and families and all of the access to education, and too many people are being left behind.
Well, let me two things that are worth your listeners keeping in mind. One, there are interesting findings with the kindergarten readiness, and it's new data, so we're really digging into it. But there are places that are quite affluent that don't do as well as you'd expect, and there are areas where there's a great deal of poverty. They're doing much, much better than you'd expect. We need to dig into why that is. So it's not the one-to-one correlation you might think. The other thing that I think is, though, worth emphasizing is that as a state, we have under-resourced every stage of our education continuum, but we've really made a huge push in the last 5 years in the K-12 space. So we used to be the 45th worst funded. We're now the 29th funded, which for the fifth largest economy in the state, which we are, that is still terrible.
We're on the right direction.
But that's a huge gain in a short period of time.
High school student counselors ratios by state. Okay, this, you have a bunch of charts and graphs and things like that.
Fascinating, right?
It is. It really is. Can people get this report that I have in my hand?
www.advanceillinois.org, and then you can go crazy with the charts, the graphs, and then the data tables.
We're 43rd. In the country, the high school student to counselor ratio is 320 students to one.
Shockingly bad.
God.
And that's at high school. It's even worse in elementary school. And I'm not remembering the number off the top of my head, but I think it's right around 1,000 per kid, which if you think about it, I mean, you're not providing any of the supports you need. And I will say, and again, I think when you look at the fact that we have so many districts that are so deeply underfunded, half of the districts in Illinois right now, even despite our increases, are funded at less than 70% of what they need, which means they have thousands of dollars a kid less than they need. And one of the things that gets sacrificed are things like social workers and counselors and enrichment.
Don't we know about that as we follow the mm-hmm. Chicago Teachers Union, a potential strike on the 17th?
Well, and by the way, CPS, 67% funded. They have 67 cents on the dollar of what they actually need to serve their students. So just understand that's happening in the context of a deeply under-resourced district.
We're out of time. Here's another graph. Demographic gap persists between teachers and students. While 26% of the students in the state are Latinx, 6% of the teachers are.
There is. I'm so glad you mentioned that. There's so much to cover. I wasn't sure where we'd get to, but that is a huge challenge. We've got a dual problem that we've got not enough teachers. We used to make grow more teachers than we needed. Now we're not. And there's a huge mismatch demographically, which it's going to take a really deliberate approach on the part of the state over a period of years for us to really fix that. That's going to have to be a priority.
Please come back. Robin Staines is the president of Advance Illinois. Get this report, for goodness sakes. It's very easy to digest. It's fascinating. It's eye-friendly. You get it by going to
www.advanceillinois.org.
Robin, nicely done.
Thanks for having me.